How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Welcome back, my friends, to Hempers Inn. I'm Vivian McPeak. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hempers Inn, email me at hempersinn@gmail.com. Today on the show, we are joined by someone whose life work has been deeply rooted, literally and figuratively, in the fight for cannabis freedom. Todd McCormick is a lifelong cannabis activist, medical marijuana patient, author, and cultivator who's dedicated decades to advancing both the science and the culture of the plant. From being diagnosed with cancer at a young age and discovering the healing benefits of cannabis to playing an active role in medical marijuana research, Todd has lived the movement from inside and out. He's written the influential book, How to Grow Medical Marijuana, and edited Jack Herer's landmark hemp and cannabis book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. Todd's activism has taken him from courtrooms to grow rooms, from writing and speaking to hands-on cultivation, all while standing firmly for patient rights, legalization, education. It's even taken him here with me today. Hey, Todd, welcome.
Good morning, bro. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. You know, we go so far back, my friend. Like me,
30 years.
You've been in cannabis advocacy since the 1990s, and you were arrested. You served prison time for cultivating cannabis during a time when public opinion was very different. There's so much to cover, but let's just begin by me asking you, what originally inspired your passion for the plant? How has that evolved over the decades? And how did that experience of being incarcerated shape your views on the justice system and drug policy? I know that's a lot to unpack.
That is. Well, when I was a child, I was diagnosed with a type of cancer called histiocytosis X. And in 1972, they did not understand it very well. So they were very aggressive with the chemotherapy, the radiation, and the surgeries. And between ages 2 and 10, I had the disease 9 times. And my mom was at her wit's end at the last of it. And she actually read in Good Housekeeping that they were giving cannabis to medical patients. And she asked my pediatrician, he told her, look, you know, you don't have anything to lose. So she gave me some cannabis on the way home from a radiation and chemotherapy treatment that day. It was combined. We were going through both of them. And it really changed my whole perspective. When I got home, I wanted some spinach. She thought I was really high. And it made a big difference. And as I got older, I went into a bit of a spontaneous remission at that point. I didn't have cancer for another 5 years. And I started studying cannabis and getting really into it because it was a forbidden subject. I couldn't really learn about it in school. Whenever I asked my teacher about it, I would get in trouble. And it just seemed like something I really wanted to learn about after experiencing how much it helped me personally. And that's what kind of started me on my journey. I traded a How to Grow book by Mel Frank for a $20 bag of pot when I was only 13 years old. And I came home and I cleaned out my closet and I started growing my own cannabis from January 1984 onward. I still do. And it's been transformational for me for the fact that it helped me basically get my life back together, you know, find my optimism again and a reason to live. And other than that, not much, but that's what got me started. And fast forward to 1993, I was living in San Diego. Sorry about that. I have no way someone coming there right now. Unbelievable.
Okay.
My luck. There's nothing I can do about this right now. What the actual fuck? Sorry, this is completely annoying in this moment of my life. It's not gonna fucking stop, really.
We didn't hear much on this end.
Yeah, well, there's a fucking phone right here going off. Not anymore, because I just unplugged it. But one more time. Sorry, guys. We got to start at the top. This house is huge, and it has an actual gate. It doesn't seem like there's anybody at the gate. Yeah, guys.
Todd?
Yep.
Let about 5 seconds of silence go before you start up.
Wait a minute. I'm not going to be able to do this. I got the fucking gardener here. 1 second. It's just not going to stop. 1 second. God damn it. Hey, man, could you please let the gardener in? He just called in the middle of this interview and it fucked the whole thing up, period. The fucking guy doesn't have a schedule, which is really annoying, period. God damn it. Now he's calling the other fucking line. God damn this fucking dude. Oh, sorry, Viv. Fucking this. The gardener at this place is such a pain in the ass. He doesn't come at normal times. So now he's just ringing the gate because he wants to come in right now. And it's like, fucking people, man. Trying to get people to work a regular schedule is not as easy as it seems. Fuck. Well, the phone in here is turned off now, sir. I have assistant handling with that. Sorry about that.
You're talking about 1993, and you want to give it like count silently to 5 seconds in your head and start up again?
Sure. Would you like me to start where I met Jack?
Yeah.
Okay. Fast forward to 1993, I was living in Pacific Beach, and I read The Emperor Wears No Clothes by Jack Herer, and I was so moved by his book that I called the number in the back of the book just to say thank you to him, because as a younger kid, I always felt like a ne'er-do-well because I was using cannabis and making a bad decision, I guess, as society always cast over me. But when I read his book and learned about the history and the medical uses and the nutrition and the hemp seed and the politics around it, it really changed my view of it. And when I drove up to meet him, I found out he was trying to legalize cannabis by collecting 500,000 signatures in California to put it on the ballot. And that really made a difference to me. And I became an activist and really did everything I could to help him and join him in his mission.
Todd, as long as I've known you, you've been a driven, industrious force to be reckoned with. I mean, you kind of never stop. I was just going through my boxes of archives that I struggle to maintain, and I recently came across your Hempire Expo paperwork from 2010. And but you got stuff going on now. Tell us all about your current work and project. What do you got going on today?
My new activism has been Authentic Genetics. I've been disseminating, selling cannabis seeds since 2018, when the hemp farm bill changed and it made all parts of the plant with less than 0.3% THC legal, I saw an opportunity. So I pivoted from having a nursery, which I've had in California since 2004, to having a seed business. And now I have over 17,000 growers behind me. I have growers in all 50 states, 23 countries growing the genetics that I have. And what makes them interesting is that I was good friends with a lot of the older breeders, such as Skunkman Sam, Mel Frank, Seattle Greg, who were responsible for things like Durban Poison, Skunk One, bringing Original Haze into the community again, Northern Lights. And because they liked me, because of my activism, they gave me their genetics to disseminate. So I have what I call the primary colors of cannabis, the Original Haze and the Original Skunk Ones that still smell skunky. And I have the Original Purest Indica that circulated as hash plant because it smells like hash when you break up and you smell your fingers. It's really quite incredible, actually. And they're like time capsules in a seed. And I get a lot of great feedback from it every day because a lot of people it's very nostalgic to go back to what they remember 30 years ago. And I still have it.
How has genetic diversity of cannabis changed since the days of underground growing to today's more regulated market? Are we losing something important, or are we gaining something powerful, or is it both?
Well, there's a combination of things happening. Unfortunately, you know, this the modern push for cultivation is pushing us all towards plants that flower in less than 9 weeks. Most of the legal cannabis producers do not touch plants that flower between 10 and 16 weeks. So we're really lacking the diversity that we had 30 years ago, because going back 30 years, we had people, or 40 years ago, you had import cannabis. So there was an evolution in the understanding of cannabis, I would say, because in the early 60s, late 50s, everything that was coming into America was tropical. Things like Cambodia and Vietnam, Thailand, Mexican, Acapulco Gold, Michoacan, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold, Jamaican, it's all tropical. And then when the hippies went across Afghanistan before the Russian invasion, they started collecting genetics, and Afghan varieties started making their way to America in the mid-70s, and it changed the face of cannabis, because these broadleaf, fast-flowering plants were able to be cultivated in more northern areas, and that really started the growing boom in America. And a lot of what we have now are combinations of varieties from Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Hindu Kush Mountains that flower easily, that are what we call broadleaf varieties, and they're combined with narrow leaf varieties. A lot of people call them sativa, but it's really wrong. Sativa, technically, when it was coined to cannabis, meant most useful, or to sow, meaning put it in your garden. For instance, there's a lettuce sativa, but it doesn't mean that it's a long flowering psychedelic head of lettuce. It just means that you should grow it in your garden because it's useful. And then years later, when indica was attached to it, it literally meant of or like India. And there are a lot of items that are called indica that have nothing to do with cannabis. And it's only because they derived from India. And India was like the first original culture of cannabis. And there was a lot of good varieties there. And everyone around the world understood that, which is why indica was related to the drug varieties and sativa was related to the industrial varieties. Because prior to us really enjoying cannabis, medicinally, I should say, we were using it industrial. All of our fabrics, all of our ropes, all of our fabrics, I mean, all of our oils and varnishes. I mean, when you think of something like Columbus's ship, it wasn't just the ropes and the riggings, the clothing, the maps, the Bibles, the lamp oil. It was also the sealant. The paint varnish they used was from hemp seed oil. The oakum that they would use, which was tar mixed with hemp fibers, and they would mat it together and put it into the planks of the board so the boat would be buoyant, was all pretty important things. I believe that without the cannabis plant, Eurasia would not have been able to evolve the way that it did, because things like paper were important, and cooking oils and lamp oils, and even the great art in Europe is painted on canvas, which is a cognate of cannabis, because all canvas came from cannabis. So the art depicting our history is literally painted on cannabis fibers using cannabis hemp seed oil as paints mixed with pigments. So its connection to humanity, to me, is pretty profound.
And of course, literature wouldn't exist, right, in its modern form with books and publications, because it was hemp parchment. And there's no aspect of our life, really, that you can't trace back to this plant. You mentioned sativa and indica. There's this idea that's very common that sativa is heady and energetic, and indica is kind of couch lock. What do you think of that?
The terms are just misnomers. I mean, they're used by people that don't understand what they're saying most of the time. When they're saying sativa, what they're trying to say is tropical equatorial. Because to a grower, a sativa means a long flowering, low yielding, loose spindly buds. And an indica means a quick flowering, heavy yielding, dense buds. To a smoker, indica means sedative, and sativa means energetic. But really what both groups miss is the fact that the plants evolved very differently between the equator and more northern areas. They had to acclimate in the equator area to be able to grow and flower simultaneously, because when they're born down by the equator, they're born into basically a flowering room. So they had to adjust, which is why what we call sativa grows and flowers simultaneously, whereas what we call indica stops its springtime growth and starts to flower once it realizes the summer solstice is there and that flowering time has started. So they react differently, and it's because in the northern areas, the plants are anticipating a cold winter and they have to make their seeds quickly, and the buds are dense because that way they can protect the seeds from the cold weather. The opposite would be what we call sativa, because those buds are loose and spindly because down by the equator, it's very humid, and they had to adapt to making loose and spindly buds that could rapidly dissipate the humidity rather than rot and die. So it's characteristics of not just how it grows, it's because of where it was growing. And when we grow it in our closets and we grow it in our greenhouses, it's changing again because you're getting environmental adaptations. And it's a fascinating study. I mean, I've been growing now over 40 years and I feel like I learn a little bit more every day. The latest thing that we've been learning about is what causes cannabis to smell skunky, which is a compound called a thiol. For people listening, that's spelled T-H-I-O-L. And it's also the compound on a skunk's butt that causes the skunk to smell bad. It's also the compound on hops that causes beer to smell skunky. And it's also a compound that develops on food that we can detect in parts per trillion that basically tells us, hey, food's going bad, you should avoid it, which is pretty fascinating because a lot of the older cannabis made thiols. And we as a collective community kind of bred away from it because I tell people when they go hiking, they don't stop and stick their nose in some, you know, pile of poop. They stop and they smell the flowers. So collectively as breeders and selectors of cannabis, we moved away from the stinky smell and we moved more towards the smells that were foods and fruits and flowers, which we liked. So cannabis kind of evolved over the last 30 years. And when I started my seed company, a lot of people believed that the stinky smell of cannabis was completely lost. And I got some seeds from Mel Frank that had been sitting in his refrigerator for, I'm not exaggerating, 23 years. I got them in 2019. He had harvested them in the summer of 96. He had gotten them from Skunkman Sam in 88, put them in his refrigerator for 8 years, didn't bother to grow them. And when I grew them out in 2020, they still smelled horrible. They smelled acrid. So I reproduced the most acrid of those rubber plants, and they've been my best seller for the last 5 years because people have a nostalgic desire for that old kind of cannabis they grew up with. So we still have that, and I still have Original Haze. I got it from Skunkman Sam. He had saved that variety since the early 70s. It is absolutely unique. And Seattle Greg popped into my life and provided me with Purist Indica, which I call the Steve Murphy Afghan, because Steve Murphy was a prominent figure in the 70s that owned a shop called the Indoor Sun Shop up in Seattle. And he wrote a cannabis cultivation book in the early to mid 70s called How to Grow Marijuana Indoors Under Lights, which was absolutely phenomenal. He wrote a very up-to-date, it's what we use now. It had 10 by 20 trays. It had CO2 enrichment. It had cloning techniques. He really wrote a modern grow book. At the same time, he was selling the grow equipment from his shop, and that attracted growers, and him and Seattle Greg became friends, and that's how Seattle Greg ended up getting Purist Indica. He got a few seeds or more from Steve in 1979, and then he basically reproduced them, passed them out to his friends, and then they started crossing them with what they were already growing and giving them back to Greg, and that became what we know as Northern Lights. That was born in the Seattle area in the early 80s, late 70s. And then those seeds, very famously, some of them went to the Netherlands to start, you know, what ended up starting the first really large international seed distribution company called the Holland Seed Bank. And now, you know, basically Northern Lights made a huge impact in modern cannabis. And a lot of it started right there in Seattle.
Yeah, all my first grow equipment came from the Indoor Sun Shop. And I talked to Steve several times, you know, many times, and, you know, just like a movement, you know, a force to be reckoned with. How do you view the current kind of iteration of cannabis legalization, commercialization, commoditization? And how does it align with the goals of the early medical marijuana movement? And, you know, if you could wave a magic hemp stalk, how would you make it better?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. From state to state, it's different. So in states like California, where we have the right to grow our own and it's only a misdemeanor to grow any amount, it's working out really well for the medical patient. I mean, here in California, for instance, it was a felony to cultivate medical cannabis between the years of 1996 and 2016 when we had something called 215, which was a horrible, horrible law. It didn't legalize anything. It put us all in legal jeopardy is what it really did. And for those 20 years that we had a medical cannabis law, it was a felon. I went to prison for 5 out of those 20 years for cultivating my own medicine. It was a horrible law. But when we passed actual legalization, Proposition 64 in 2016, it reduced all felony cultivation charges down to misdemeanors, and it created a legal system for the distribution, the testing, the regulation of cannabis, which I think people deserve. I mean, just like they deserve to go into a supermarket and get clean food, I think they should be able to go into a store and get clean cannabis. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I wanted always to see the cost of cannabis drop. I always hoped that when legalization would happen, you know, the producers would just charge a reasonable amount above cost of production and we'd all be able to get, you know, access to high quality cannabis. That's not what's happened, unfortunately. A lot of the people that have been getting into this industry, they see prohibition era profits and they want, you know, they want to make the kind of money people made 30 years ago while they were, you know, growing under the threat of police raids and their dogs being shot and their cars being seized and their homes being seized. I mean, at one point I was held on $1 million bond simply because I grew my own cannabis in my backyard. I didn't have guns. I didn't have drugs. I didn't have anything other than flowers in my backyard. And they held me on $1 million bond, was reduced to $500,000 and posted by the actor Woody Harrelson at the time. But still, how ridiculous is that? And now with legalization, you don't see people being held on $1 million bond or $500,000 bond because they grew some flowers. And medical patients, like for instance, here in California, have easier access to the plant. In other states, unfortunately, like Washington, where the law wasn't as good and then there wasn't really any follow-up after the law passed, you have less rights. And then we could go state by state to state to break down Florida and Massachusetts, Oklahoma, which was wild, wild west. So it's very different in very different states. What we don't have is federal legalization yet. And I don't even know how that's going to feel because the federal government has been very unfavorable towards cannabis for a long time. They're the ones that made it, you know, that Marijuana Tax Act. They're the ones that prohibited farmers from being able to use it to compete with things like cotton and synthetics. So the federal government has been a tool of big business. They have not been on the side of personal and civil liberties of its citizens. So I don't have a lot of faith in the federal government coming along and making this better. But with the move to Schedule 3, I do support it. Getting the federal government to admit that cannabis has medical use has been something we've been trying to do for a very long time. 31 years ago, I drove all the way across the country to go to what we called National Medical Marijuana Day in November of 1994. And we had a rally and a protest across the street from the White House and Peace Park because the Federation of American Scientists had created a position paper saying that whole raw cannabis was medically useful. And we in the industry, I'm sure you remember it, Vivian, were all very excited, thinking this is going to change the world because everybody listens to scientists, right? Well, it turns out nobody listens to scientists. And 31 years later, there has been absolutely no change in the federal law at all. If anything, it's gotten worse. And they've ignored states' rights. They've ignored the 10th Amendment. They've ignored the will of the people for the most part. And it sucks. And I think that moving to Schedule 3 is a step in the right direction. At the same time, there's a lot of people calling for complete descheduling. And I've always argued that it should never have been put in the schedule. But right now we have states policing the intrastate activities, meaning if it's grown in Humboldt and it's sold in LA, it has nothing to do with the feds under state rights laws. Same with Washington, Oklahoma, etc. Once we have removed cannabis from the CSA entirely, it's going to fall under the jurisdiction of probably the ATF. It'll become the Cannabis, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And I don't know how people are going to like that, because that'll create the feds to come and knock on your cannabis door and regulate you rather than the state, which in some ways the states have been a lot more liberal, state to state varying, than I think the federal government will ever be. So I tell my friends, be careful what you wish for. You may just get it, and it may not feel as good as you think it does.
Yeah, it feels like if the federal government does change the paradigm, it won't be for the right reasons. Speaking of Schedule 3, how do you see pharmaceutical interests influencing the future of cannabis access?
It's already been there. Roxane Labs has patented what is synthetic THC, dronabinol, going back to the 70s. It's been released on the market since the mid-80s. I mean, a lot of people don't seem to really understand that we've had synthetic cannabinoids floating around for quite a while. They don't sell well. They don't do well. Marinol has absolutely no street value, as the DEA said in 1999 when they moved it from Schedule 2 to Schedule 3. Synthetic THC has been Schedule 3 since really July of 1999. And it's because nobody wants it. Nobody cared for it. I mean, it just doesn't work as a single molecule the same way the complexity of cannabis works. Minor cannabinoids, the regulation or the of the terpenes, the way that they regulate the cannabinoids, it makes a big difference. So in some ways, I have no fear of, you know, Dr. Lester Grinspoon, rest his soul, used to dream of the day where we would be able to go to the doctors and they would be able to test our endocannabinoid system, tell us which areas we were deficient in, and then hand us the basically phytocannabinoids, cannabinoids derived from a plant that we needed to balance our system, because our system makes endocannabinoids, which are neurotransmitters similar to the THC, for instance, in cannabis, and it goes into the same receptor and it makes us feel happy, horny, hungry, reduces our pain, same thing. And I'm making the argument in my new book, From Cancer to Cannabis, The Essential Guide to the Endocannabinoid System, that cannabinoids should be more considered like vitamins and minerals rather than drugs, because our body makes similar neurotransmitters. And in instance, anandamide, or AEA, it's called, is the chemical equivalent to THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. When the plant makes THC, it's a phytocannabinoid from the plant. When our body makes it, it's a neurotransmitter in our body. But at the same time, it's the same chemical, goes into the same receptor, and causes us to feel the same way. So I'm making the argument in my book that just like vitamin D, for instance, your body can make it naturally in the sunlight, or you can use it through a supplement, or get it in your food. We need cannabinoids. We need it for what's called homeostasis, which is the balance of our body. And it is a crime to prohibit nutrients from our body. And the reason I believe that we're all getting so sick and we're getting cancer at the rates we're getting is because by taking away all of these phytocannabinoids, they have disrupted our body's ability to maintain its own health.
We only have about 4 minutes left. You know, you mentioned your mom, Anne, who passed away recently, sadly, in my condolences on Anne, who's a friend of mine as well. She knew to give you medical cannabis when you were young with you know, dealing with cancer. Was she from the cannabis culture? Could you talk about that?
My mom was a young hippie. She was like 19 when I was born, and she was, you know, hippie. A lot of hippies enjoyed and embraced cannabis. I grew up with my mom being what I would call a parlor dealer. She sold cannabis to her friends. She used to pick it up. You know, she wasn't a very big dealer. But she'd get quarter pounds, half pounds, pounds, and then just break it into bags and then sell it to her friends. And I grew up around that. You know, I grew up around her friends sitting in the living room, smoking joints, talking, listening to Bob Dylan, you know, Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead. And this was my childhood. And on a lot of levels, I feel like cannabis was something that they rebelled with. And my mom had her own personal experiences, so she was willing to give it to me and see how I liked it and see how it felt. And it helped me a profound amount. I mean, it gave me the ability to feel better again while I was going through chemo and radiation. It reduced my nausea, it reduced my pain. It kind of gave me some optimism back, because at the time I was really feeling down and depressed because I was facing death. And that's why now I'm such an activist, because I kind of feel like I owe cannabis. Like, she saved my butt, and I'm trying to tell the world that it would be a better place if they'd understand it better, because that's been my goal for a long time. You know, we've made the movies The Union, The Business Behind Getting High, with Joe Rogan, Dr. Les Grinspoon, Dr. Todd McCurry, Tommy Chong's in it. And then my second documentary we make was called The Culture High. We got Snoop Dogg, Wiz Khalifa, Joe Rogan, Richard Branson launched it for us on his own regard. The whole goal for a long time has been education. I mean, that was our goal with Seattle Hemp Fest. It was trying to get people to understand what we knew and to try to make it palatable so they would come down and they would celebrate freedom and hopefully walk away with a better understanding of what Betsy Ross made the first flag out of, or what Ben Franklin created his first hemp paper mill with.
We've got about a minute and a half. What final thought? First of all, how can people cover, follow your work and your seeds and stuff? And what final thoughts would you like to leave us with, Tobin?
Oh, anybody can find me at Authentic Genetics. Just type my name, Todd McCormick, into Google. It'll pop right up. My website is agseedco.com, agseedco.com. And seeds are available there, and we ship immediately. And any questions people have, they can hit me up. There's a chat. There's a phone number on the website. There's an email. It's just todd@agseedco.com. And I'm happy to help people. I feel honored to be the person in between the old breeders with all the old genetics that we all, you know, heard about and were moved by, and to be able to provide them to the new community, or not the new community, but the younger community, the newly legal cannabis community is what I want to say. And a lot of why I'm doing this is because I don't think that legal cannabis is going to share the genetics with people. I think a lot of these producers are going to see our work as IP and try to grab our clones and put it in a jar. And we're never going to get the seeds. We're never going to get the cuttings. We're just going to get sold overpriced cannabis, you know, by the eighth. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. And by me being able to get the genetics into the hand of the people, hopefully we can circumvent the production of the big producers coming in and trying to say, you know, you got to get it from us now and we're going to overcharge you. So my argument to anybody listening to this is fight for home grow, fight for your rights to grow your own. Say no to corporate cannabis in the sense that they're just charging us overpriced pot, and make it yourself.
I know you're really busy. You have so much going on. It was a challenge even to get this scheduled. Thank you so much, Todd, my old friend, for taking time out.
Well, I admire you very much, Vivian. You know, you've been one of the voices of reason for decades, and I thank you for having me on, and I thank you for everything you did with Seattle Hemp Fest. I think you made a huge difference in the 30 years that you were doing it.
Thanks, Todd.
Much
well, here for music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand, the outro music, Take Back the Pepper Stick. We'll see you next time. Marijuana, THC, sweet sativa.
How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.